Welcome to Tackle HIV, Talking Stigma with Gareth Thomas. I'm Sally Gunnell, and throughout this series, we are talking to Gareth and other well-known guests about stigma and resilience. What stigma is, what it's like to experience it, how to overcome it, and what needs to be done to make stigma a thing of the past. Now, joining Gareth and I is the amazing and inspirational athlete and global speaker, Dame Kelly Holmes. Welcome to both of you.
Hey.
Hello.
Thank you.
Oh, I'm really, really looking forward to this. Now, Kelly, when I read through what you have achieved, it's absolutely incredible. So you joined the British Army, age 17, initially as an HGV driver in the Women's Royal Army Corps before training as a physical training instructor, recognised in 1998 by the now King Charles when you were awarded an MBE for services in the British Army. You are now a proud veteran. Sounds old, doesn't it, almost?
Doesn't it?
Now, you've had such an illustrious athletics career, 12 years, during which you claimed multiple medals at the Commonwealth, European, World's Olympic level. That pinnacle came in 2004 at the Athens Olympic Games, where you made history as the first British woman ever to win two gold medals in a single Olympics in that 1500 and 800. Now, I'd like to think
you
I was
there.
Part of-
and you were there.
I know I was there, and I handed you the peanuts. So after each round, so I feel like I'm part of that.
I feel like I'm part of it because I was like, there, go on, Kelly.
It was incredible. Now, in recognition of your achievements in sport, you were honoured with a damehood by the late Queen Elizabeth in 2005. You're also a charity founder, winner of multiple awards as a sportswoman, a philanthropist, I'm going to get my teeth in for that one, and a speaker. She is a beacon of strength and relentless energy, a champion and voice of acceptance, confidence and striving for excellence. Now, since retiring from athletics in 2005, Kelly, you have founded the Dame Kelly Holmes Trust, where athletes, mentors support young people for facing disadvantages across the UK. You're a committed and vocal advocate for mental health and diversity and inclusion, and actively works to improve health and well-being. Wow, what a list. I can't believe, you know, I've never been on the other side and actually interviewed you like this. So it's lovely. Normally we just have little chats in coffee shops or in nice restaurants.
Exactly.
It's absolutely lovely. Now we're going to come to you in a minute and all talk together. But just to you, Gareth, now you've shared experience and perspective with Kelly, but I'm sure there's lots, but it's 2026 and more than 40 years since the first case of HIV was reported. Living with HIV now is so different to how it was then. We have learned so much about the virus since that first case, but sadly, attitudes have not kept up with the advances in science. HIV is still misunderstood because of that stigma still exists. HIV now is a manageable condition and has been for many years. However, most people living with HIV have experienced stigma in one form or another, from being excluded or shunned by family and friends to being discriminated against work or elsewhere or being verbally abused. The fear of stigma prevents people from getting tested and seeking healthcare, which increases HIV grip on people who are most at risk. And people living with HIV report higher rates of anxiety and depression than those who don't. And stigma is a key factor in this. Now, this has got to be why you started this campaign, isn't it, Gareth?
Yeah, that and many other reasons, I suppose. For me, it's a version of self-stigma. So when I first found out about my diagnosis, like, I'm a very proud product of my upbringing, of my parenting, of my schooling, of my social circle, of my friends. And when I first had my diagnosis, the first thing I thought was, ultimately, this is the end for me. So I'm going to die inevitably, probably a slow, painful death. And I quickly realised, when I started to listen to the medical profession. That wasn't the case anymore. But also then I realised that if I'm a product of my upbringing, then everything I've been taught is what everybody else around me thinks. So I started and was really passionate about starting this campaign because I wanted people to know what I knew, because it creates a better world. It created a better environment, whether it affects you or not. There's certain degrees of separation to people that it will affect. But also what I wanted to do was something, and again, I think the both of you, especially Kelly, will understand this, is in life you learn in two different ways. So somebody can verbally give you information and you can take it in and you can absorb it. Or somebody can do that. But what they can also do is stand up and show you something. Therefore, when you have that verbal information plus somebody showing you, there's no way you can deny it. And it just felt like when we were giving out the verbal information, part of this campaign was a big thing to be like, you know what, I don't want to have to stand up in front of a room of people who already know about the virus, have a round of applause at the end of it and walk out feeling great. I want to take this message to the people who really need this message, the ones who are not coming to us. And there was a way of doing that by physically doing it, by going out there and, like, you know, Sally, you've come up with us, climbing up mountains, you know, taking really physical challenge. Because so many people have this assumption that people living with HIV are physically weak, you know, that are pale, are struggling to do things. So to give them this verbal information, to set up this campaign to also physically show people was a really good way of kind of changing the narrative and getting people to take notice of us, you know, constantly doing it, not just being one message, but being the same message in different ways for many years.
Well, you've certainly done that, and I've loved being part of a couple of your campaigns that you've done. Now, Kelly, you have spoken before about the challenges in your childhood and at school before finding your way in the army and through athletics. You are passionate about the journey of self-acceptance and the importance of being true to oneself and finding that sort of mental and physical health and happiness. You've kept your sexuality secret for many years. Because you feared losing your career in the British Army due to being illegal during that time you served in the military. I can't believe that. Tell us about that journey and why you felt unable to be your authentic self, even though throughout your whole athletics career and the impact that it had on your mental health as well. And I know that as well. So, just explain.
Well, I think, you know, there's different situations in life, isn't there? You know, when you're in different eras, I think, you know, Gareth will understand that with obviously HIV and AIDS, you know, for the 80s and 90s, and having been somebody lived through that era and understanding the complexities and the issues that were around there, you know that stigma is something that's going to hit somebody very personally for their mental health and their well-being because of what, you know, some people will just feel that, you know, what's the consequences of you really being open and vulnerable when there's so many, right, in different worlds? But for me, you know, living through the army, it was illegal, you know, so the risk of losing my career was something that I wasn't going to take that risk. So basically, I didn't know I was gay when I first joined the army. I mean, I was just a young kid that did sport and ran around. You know, it wasn't something I was exploring my sexuality. I didn't really come. We didn't learn anything different in school. So, you know, I just wasn't aware. And then obviously joining the army, I became aware that maybe I was attracted to women. It wasn't anything really sexual. It's just a kind of where I felt more comfortable, I suppose, and joining the Women's Royal Army Corps, it was all women anyway. The ironic thing was it was against the law to be gay, but we knew everybody was in, pretty much 80% of them were gay anyway. You know? And the weird thing at this time, you know, when you're young, you just find it quite funny because you're told you can't sit on a bed unless you've got with somebody else, unless you've got one toe on the floor. You know what I mean? It was just all these really bizarre things. We used to laugh about it. You know what I mean? And then we used to do these pretend marriages where, of course, it was all women, you know, and I would be the vicar and somebody with a bridesmaid pulling down the neck curtains. And then you just realise that the groom was, oh, she's gay because, you know, that's why she took the groom position. It was all these funny things when you were younger. I think when I started to go for my career, get promoted and have rank responsibility, that's where it became more frightening, because of course I didn't want to lose my career. I loved being in the military, and we had things like raids, so people would come in, Royal Military Police would literally come into your barracks trying to, as we call it now, a witch hunt, finding out if people were gay or might be assumed to be gay. I mean, that's how ridiculous it was. And basically, that led to fear. I mean, to cut a long story short, it led to fear of being found out. Now, the thing is with me is also, as you know, became an elite athlete. No one was out in elite sport. Like, no. I didn't know anyone that was gay. It had no role models, no safety net, no one to talk to. Yeah, I was also in the army. So I had these two things that became really difficult. And over the years, I know we're going to talk about it, but over the years, the fear that I had from being a 22-year-old being raided to coming out as an elite, to being an elite athlete in a world where there was still a lot of stigma in the 90s. No one talked about mental health problems. No one really expressed how they really felt. And that had a detrimental effect on me, my health and my, you know, personality really and everything.
Do you know, yeah, and you're talking, that's a lot of years that you were under that, weren't you, if you know what I mean, and felt like that. It's not just one or 2 years.
I mean, I've been gay since I was, knownly gay since I was 18, and I didn't come out publicly till I was 39 plus 30.
Wow.
But do you feel, Kelly, right? Because it's interesting listening to you. Because I know for me, and it sounds like success becomes what everybody else strives for. But then success, as you talk about success in the army and with it being illegal to be gay, and success in sport and nobody. Did you feel like success, even though you strove for success, was maybe a part of success, was the worst thing ever to happen to? Because you realise the more successful you become, then the more open you're going to become, or the more vulnerable you're going to become about things that don't define you, but you feel like are very irrelevant for other people to know, yet people find it really relevant. They want to know these things.
Yeah. I don't know. I think I had two different ways of looking at it. I think I'd held it in so long and was able to live my life without anyone really questioning. People might have questioned, but I didn't. Then no one ever came to me and asked me outright. And you've got to remember, back in early 2000s, we didn't have what we know now as a social media exposure. It was newspapers, radios, TVs, and you're lucky as a woman to be on those. And, you know, Sally knows, you know, one of our greatest ever athletes, you get your airtime when you do really well, and then after that kind of fizzles out. Right. So I suppose in one way, I didn't really overthink it, because I'd blocked it out so much. I was like in jail in my head, like, I blocked it out so much that was the divide, is that if I believe no one knew, then that couldn't hurt me. You know what I mean? And if I ever done interviews, no one ever was allowed to ask me anything personal. And I had enough, you know, my success in my athletics and my army career was my barrier. I could talk about being a female in the military, you know, in the army. I could talk about being an elite athlete, Olympic champion, all those things were not stories to tell. My background, my upbringing, being in a care home. Like, I had so many different things that I could talk about. Didn't actually have to go about me. The reason why I had to come out was for me. It was for my life. It wasn't for other people. And so the success at that time really wasn't. I think the later years it's become worse. You know, as social media became a thing, I was getting jealous of all the young ones coming out, just living their life all freely and happy and not having any consequences because they didn't have fear. And I was just like, not jealous because I didn't want them to have it, but felt like I have none of that. You know, they're all living their life and I have literally none of it. I had no happiness in that sense. And so, yeah, I think it wasn't really about success being a fear. It was more the fact that I needed at that time to be more open because everyone else was, and I didn't know how I could live my life not in these day and age.
What made that change almost, seeing so many people being free? After so many years, what made that change for you?
It became untenable, really. It's just like, I just hate it. It was exhausting to avoid conversation, to not just be normal. I was like, where are you going on holiday? Oh, I'm going with my partner. No, I'm going with my friend. You know, I'm going with a group of friends, collective, or this is my PA or my, you know, best mate or whatever. Never, ever would, you know, and And what you realise is it doesn't create healthy relationships either, because I have relationships, but when the other person who's not in the public eye has to keep, you know, go from in their world being open to not being heard, not being seen, not being whatever, that's a disaster for relationships, because even though they think they can handle it, they can't, you know, because in their words, they become invisible, because I'm not going to let, no one's going to know about you, yeah. You know, and it just became exhausting. So the real thing of why I came out was because, I suppose, well, in lockdown, I literally couldn't cope with I felt like I couldn't breathe, like I literally couldn't cope. And I considered taking my life one night, and then I realised that, well, I have a life to live. It was also the whole thing of, you know, having friends and family saying, oh, isn't it a shame she can't live her life? And I thought, isn't that my right? My right to say that while I'm here, not for other people to say it when I'm not.
Yeah.
And it absolutely became a mind game.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Now, I just want to go back to that army experience and the stigma around that. Because it's only recently, isn't it, that the law has been changed to allow people living with HIV to be fully deployed and work in any role, which is incredible. Now, that has obviously taken a lot of campaigning for those changes to happen. What do you think of that, and where the military is at now?
You know, from both sides, the military is in a, you know, in a much better place than it ever was. You know, the ban for LGBT, as it was known then, got lifted in 2000. So it went from 1967 to 2000. So relatively a short period of time of transition, because then after that, of course, it doesn't ultimately just change. You've still got ignorance. You've still got people with their old brain on. You've still got these ridiculous thoughts that, you know, somebody that's gay can't go and fight for their country, yet actually they might lose their life fighting for their comrades. You know, it became stupid. So that, and then people now live their life freely in the military. You can join up very much in every, for a female perspective, every role is now available. If you're good enough, you're good enough. If you're not, and that stands for men and women, as far as I'm concerned. But equally, there are more rights to live your life authentically in the military. Now, I'm not saying it's easy. Some people probably still get a lot of, shit.
Go for it.
Still get a lot of issues. But the laws change, i.e. now you can get done for homophobia and racism and everything. But just to go back a little bit with Gareth, you know, back in the day, in the 80s, you know, we, as a young kid, you know, I joined the army in 88. So I was very aware of the sort of AIDS epidemic and the world around HIV. And you know, in the military, people used to talk about it quite a lot as well. It wasn't just, you know, a civilian thing. And I think what one that changed, well, maybe before I joined the army, I think what made me look very differently, it was two things. Was one, you know, when you saw, and you do need high profile people to change that mold sometimes, when you saw Princess Diana, firstly, going in, you know, to hospitals and that, and you just look and you just think straight away that changed everything that anyone used to think, you know, all of the innuendos and all that, because seeing someone like that just cuddling people and thinking, hold on a minute, have we got this wrong? And then the other thing that was, I only really realised quite recently, was I personally don't like being called a lesbian. So I like to identify myself as a gay woman. And the reason why is that the L word, the lesbian world, was very stigmatized. You know, in the army, it used to be called a lesbian. You know, you're either someone who gets screwed up against the wall, or is like a, you know, it's just like awful connotations to the word lesbian. Yeah. And then it was only recently on one of those things that Danny Minogue did, when a girl, what's the one Danny Minogue did? Boy Kissed the Boy?
No. Oh, yeah. Oh, gosh. I Kissed the Boy or I Kissed the Girl.
So I watched that, and I've never really watched anything like that. And I just thought, oh, just watch it. Just, I don't know, being inquisitive. And there was a conversation between some younger actual women who says, do you realise why the L became first? It used to start with the G. And the reason why it was the L is because during the AIDS crisis, it was lesbian women who were the first point of contact and support for gay men that were suffering with HIV and AIDS. And so it was the gay men around that time that actually said that L needs to come first because of all the support they gave. I don't know if you know about that, Gareth.
No, I didn't know about that.
LGBT is because the guy said no, the women are the ones that were there for us through everything and they should be put first. So it doesn't change my world that I still want to be called a gay woman, but now reason why, a lot of women like to be a lesbian.
Isn't it interesting though, I think Kelly's touching there, is how we're like, you know, we kind of hold on to things that hurt us in the past and we try and distance ourselves. Because I know, I only read this last week actually, AIDS was actually when the AIDS epidemic was around, it was first known as GRD, not AIDS, gay-related disease. And again, it's the stigma around that. Now, you know, for me to understand that it was a gay-related disease, if somebody mentioned that to me now, I'd be very, very offended. And it's kind of, I just think it's an interesting thing that people think of change, you know, when you talk about the Diana and that moment where she went and shook people's hands, and the thought of change is celebratory. But when I know this has happened to me for stigma, when is the reality of then you're faced with somebody and having to do potentially what Diana did, even though you look at it and you think it's a celebratory thing, actually then truly believing it. And that's what I say now, you know, as a campaign, we don't just do words, we like actions. So that then for somebody who is not certain or uneducated or carry stigma, for them to actually shake my hand, even though they've seen that moment, is a very, very difficult thing to do. I think we all hold on to things that affected us in the past and find it really hard to kind of comprehend that change has actually happened. I always say in this as a campaign is that what we try to do is we try to re-educate people. So people feel like they're educated so much on certain things, yet so much has changed. As you're saying, Kelly, so much has changed within the army. So much has changed within sport. So much has changed within language that we have to like almost erase people's memories and re-educate them with what's new now and what's acceptable now.
Do you both still feel that stigma still affects you now?
I'd be interested to know with Kelly. So, first of all, I feel stigma does affect me in a way that it's there, but I don't allow it to stop me doing things. I think it affect is, you know, I don't know, is different versions for things for different people. Listen, I kind of take it for granted that there's lots of people in society who, for whatever reason, you know, don't want to shake my hand, don't want to give me a hug, don't want to drink out of the same glass. Though I kind of accept that, but I don't let it affect me. Now, if I was to say that I live a happy, normal, healthy life, it's true, but I could walk, you know, maybe into the pub next door, and I guarantee you, even though somebody won't say it, somebody will look at me in an unaccepting way, or like in a discriminative way, or a discomfort way. So it's certainly there, and it's certainly relevant. People like Kelly, who, you know, who now advocate and are powerful kind of allies for change, help things and move things on, but it's a very slow turn. People realize now that we live in a society where you can't really stand and verbally discriminate somebody for they're afraid of a comeback, so they'll do it in different ways. They'll do it in ways that Kelly will know will affect her, that I will know will affect me. So it's definitely there, and there's definitely a need still for being active and being vocal about creating change. Just because people, you know, I say to a lot of people, or they don't see homophobia, or they don't see discriminatory things against people living with HIV. And I'm like, well, how many gay people do you know? And I don't actually know any. It's like, well, how do you know homophobia doesn't exist if you're never around people who are openly gay? Because homophobia is not going to exist in a room of heterosexual men or heterosexual women. It's just not going to exist, or it's not going to be called out. If people are calling somebody homophobic, it's not going to be called out. So you have to have a degree of association with somebody to understand discrimination and stigma still exists.
Yeah. What about you, Kelly? Do you still feel it exists?
I was going to ask Gareth, like, do you think with the, with being a gay man and having HIV, do you think the stigma is more because of the two things together, as opposed to if you were educating people around HIV and you were a gay man? Because I feel like in society, being a gay man's actually easy these days, because it's that whole, I used to always think, some of my mates, oh, I've got a gay mate. You know what I mean? It's almost like everyone likes a gay guy on their art. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
As a friend.
Do you
think those two things are?
Yeah, I think it's kind of a strange one. In a way, because I'm a gay man who's living with HIV, people can almost assume that, that's how it's going to be, because you're a gay man. And a big part of our campaigning is to realise that HIV doesn't just affect gay men. You know, it affects people of all characteristics. But people do assume that, and also they have an assumption of, I've been reckless, or I've slept with loads of different men because of of this fight. They don't really have an understanding or a care or a judgment. They make their own decision, and that's their own decision to make. But I do feel that that society struggles more because of the lack of education around HIV. I do feel people struggle more or are more fearful around me because of the virus, because, as I said, so much was highlighted in the 80s that hasn't been buried, and so much science and medicine has become so advanced that people feel like, as I said earlier, people feel like that they know how the virus is transmitted, they know how it's spread, yet the existence of living happily and healthy within, realising, like, I take one pill a day and I can live a normal, happy, healthy life. I'm not going to pass on HIV through sexual contact because I'm on effective medication. But yet people find that very difficult to understand. So I do find an air of caution around me from certain people, especially certain people of a certain generation, where they struggle to understand.
And that's what I think it is, isn't it? It's just like breaking that cycle, because, as you say, I mean, I'm more aware of it because I lived through that era, as opposed to would I be aware of it so much now, because I would have thought that science has moved on and treatments have moved on and whatever. Because, like, from the LGBT community, I mean, I was not part of it. What I find very interesting now, having come out, is I was so unaware of everything that actually went under the label community, like all the events that they have, the Attitude Awards, the Diva Awards, the European Diversity. I mean, I had no idea these things existed, like literally no idea. I didn't know one person who was in a high position in work that was gay. I actually did not know. Anyway, I think that's because I was so blinkered, so switched off, that I just went and did my thing. And I do remember probably only a couple of times, because things change over the years, haven't they, that I'd go and do speaking and they would have a pride event or something. I would be not anywhere near those rainbows. You know what I mean? I'm like, okay, so it puts a label on my head.
Yeah.
And it wasn't about, for me, it wasn't shame or embarrassment ever, because I am very aware of who I am and very happy with who I am. But the worry of judgment, the worry of how people could belittle what you've done as a person if they're so ignorant and naive to the, that whole part of living. So being gay or bisexual or whatever it may be. And so I believe I put too much credibility in everybody else's potential thought other than me actually thinking, hold on a minute, like I've got values, I respect, I'm a decent person, I've worked hard. I believe I gave other people too much hold over my life by worrying about the judgment they might put on me because I said I'm gay. Whereas now I came out, it's eradicated all of that. It's like I just feel to myself, you're the one that needs educating, understanding that people's lifestyles have nothing to do with you, no effect on your life whatsoever. But how you can be vilified, be negative, be discriminative, be, you know, hated can actually affect that person's life no end. And I just feel that we, Gareth and I, you know, now I feel like I, you know, I don't put anything on my shoulders and my head because people have gone way before me, like who, you know, stand way, way, way before me even having any form of voice, you know. But I do feel when you have a platform, it's our positioning to normalize and humanize the conversation and just say, this is what it is. I mean, if you see it in a different way, you've got those issues to go and solve. But for me, I just try and say, I want to connect people just to have a normal conversation, just to let people live.
How did you feel about that though then, Kel? Because when you were saying, like you didn't know what was going on within the LGBT community, and yet then all of a sudden you make an announcement and you are the figurehead, you are the voice, you are the representation of this huge community, and then every word you say is a representation of millions of other people, yet you don't really know what that, and I'm asking this because I've been in that position, and I'm just wondering, like, how did you deal with all of a sudden these interviews, these quotes that are just going to be magnified in every magazine, every newspaper, every news headline? You're going to be the representative of a community of people that you kind of want him sure existed.
Yeah, right.
Crazy, yeah.
So firstly, Gareth, I mean, I only had the ability to be out publicly after doing my documentary. And I did my documentary because I knew you had done one. And we obviously have a mutual guy that was in the middle of that, the agent, who I realised he had helped you do your documentary. So I had to find somebody safe, as it were, you know. And the reason why I targeted this guy to be my agent at the time was because I felt he was a safe bet to support me, knowing he had supported you, right? Because I didn't trust anyone. I literally did not trust anyone. I was just so worried about everybody. So when I went through the process of doing the documentary, I felt that that was my first landing point. And the reason why I did it as a public documentary, because I'm not young, I can't just sit on social media and go, oh, I'm gay. Like, that's a big thing, because it affected me so badly that I had to do it in a process that meant it was educational. It was informative about why it took me so long. It was out there to support other people in their journey of coming out and saying it's not easy for all of us. You know, it's just not easy. So many people come out later in life who have built their lives through other means, heterosexual couples, some of the families, you know, they've built their life and then they get to a point in life where they go, that's not me anymore. And that transition's very difficult. So I had to really think about why I was going to do it and how. Firstly, I believe that anybody's, you know, assumption is not another person's freedom. It didn't matter who thought I might be gay, might have been talking around other places, or even when I came out and said, well, of course she was gay. That didn't help me. You know, if you thought it didn't help me feel okay and happy and free. So I had to do it to free myself. And then what happened was, is I got invited to Pride, London, of all the places, London. And I was just like, I can't do this. Anyway, so Gok won. Gok won, Alison Hammond, and a few other people says, you've got to come on the ITV bus with us. And I was like, I ain't going nowhere near. Anyway, the funny thing was, is that it was funny but terrifying at the same time. So I plucked at the garage. I met with Gok. We were holding hands from the back streets of London, going towards this bus, got on the ITV bus. And of course, a lot of people in the media world are gay, right? So there's all these people, and a lot aren't. They're just allies. Love life, love everybody. So I got this bus, have all the buses on the parade. Guess who's broke down? So we had to walk. So I've gone from nothing to feeling safe on a bus and waving and walking.
It was fate. It was fate.
It was horrendous. Horrendous, because it was the best feeling. But literally within that split second,
yeah.
I had to just forced be into it.
Wow,
so
there you go. You were forced into it and changed your life. That one moment, that was it.
I know.
It.
And then, then I'm on stage speaking to hundreds of thousands of people. And I just said, you know what? I'm never going behind that curtain again. And freedom's my voice. And that was it. And then I met all Linda Riley and all the people from the gay world. And life hasn't been the same since. Now I hide from them all.
Listen, to both of you, so if anybody's listening to this podcast now, what would you say to them, you know, just moving forward?
Well, I think as far as HIV has gone, I think, again, it's all about education. Education is the key to this. And that's why at Tackle HIV, we say tacklehiv.org, which is a website which is filled with truths. I think the internet sometimes can be a rabbit hole where you go down there and, you know, it's filled with unfactual information. We're also, as a charity partner with the Terence Higgins Trust, we've set up social media accounts at Tackle HIV, where, again, you can educate yourself and others about HIV. So that, what I feel is really important, is that you treat people with HIV just as you would treat anybody else.
Brilliant, lovely. And Kelly, what about you? What would you say to people listening?
I would say, you know, firstly, you have a right to live your life, and that's really important that you do that, because I think by doing that, you support your own mental health, which is a lot of what happens, the decline in people's mental health. I'll say, you know, there's so many charities out there that are there to support you, whether you're from the LGBTQIA+ community or whether you're struggling with a mental health issue, that they're there, private tech services, ring people up. And a lot of people need support. You need to be able to share the things that are going on with people that you can trust, hopefully, people that understand, people that can guide you in the right direction, never to feel alone. You know, we hope that most people have families that will be supportive, but a lot of people don't. And that becomes then obviously another issue. And also at work, you know, not wanting to be seen or heard if your work doesn't seem supportive. But I think the whole thing of psychological safety is being in spaces where you feel the ability to be you, to talk about you and your fears, and having great people around you. And that also includes friends and families as well. So that people do have. So I think, you know, and also lastly, no one should live their life dictated by what society thinks they should live it. They should live their life because you only have one life to live. A lot of us have lost people. They haven't got a life to live. And I think it's our right to then walk this earth in the way that we want to.
Wow. Brilliant. And, you know, just knowing you personally, Kelly, it's lovely to see you so happy and so engaged and doing some incredible work out there as well. And, you know, it's taken a long time, but it's just amazing to see you.
You know, people change, right? I have no doubt changed. Without a doubt, I am a different person to what I was. You know, I still be polite, I still whatever, but I just always had a barrier. I know I did, even in my athletics career, you know, and I've always got on with you. I've loved you. And the people don't realise that they go, if you know, what the bits that do hold you back.
Yeah.
I would never have said to you, go for coffee, Sally, or go for a meal or go whatever. It's just ridiculous to think that I just didn't do anything that was normal because of that worry. But as soon as you take it off, you're just like, wow, sod you lot.
I just think really quickly on that point, I think everybody's looking, like whether it be in athletics, whether it be any sport, whether it be working in an office, whether it be, I don't know, a bin man on the street, everybody's looking to try and be the best version of themselves. Mm. And I genuinely, and I think Kelly is like one of the greatest examples of this. I genuinely believe that authenticity is the best version of yourself. Like and not only does it make the best version of yourself, but what's really important is to have people around you. And when you become authentic, the people that are around you are the people who want to be around you. Unauthenticity brings out like a negative version of you, and the people around you are not there because of who you are. They're there because who they think you are, and that's somebody completely different.
So true.
Oh, thank you. Well, what a fascinating and interesting and just, yeah, I've learned a lot about that as well. So everything. So thank you so much to both of you. Really enjoyed it. And I'm sure others will. So what you're saying, it sounds to me like it is all about compassion, communication, knowledge, education, which is what this podcast is all about. So thank you to Kelly for joining us for this episode of Talking Stigma podcast. For more information, please go to tacklehiv.org or the Terence Higgins Trust website. You can also follow us on social media at TackleHIV. So look out for any future episodes. We'll be talking to other amazing people around stigma as well. So thank you so much for listening.